Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Our guest is the poet Koresh Ali Lansana, who grew up in Enid, attended OU, and then lived in Chicago for about 30 years or so. With a sojourn to New York City to study writing at NYU for a couple of years, Koresh Ali Lansana, while in Chicago, was a very active and prolific poet and teacher of writing. He has written over the years 8 poetry books, 3 textbooks, 3 children's books. He's edited several anthologies, and he's co-authored a book on teaching. He has a new book out, The Skin of Dreams, New and Collected Poems, 1995 to 2008. It's an impressive book that gathers all of his poetry books so far and has several new poems as well. It's just come out, and he will tell us about that. He is a Tulsa Artist Fellow, and he's recently returned to Oklahoma. He now teaches at Holland Hall. He's also got a book launch and party to celebrate the release of this new book, The Skin of Dreams, happening on Saturday night, the 27th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Archer Studios. This is the Tulsa Artist Fellowship Archer Studios at 109 North MLK, and the gathering is free and open to the public. Again, Koresh Ali Lansana is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Koresh Ali Lansana, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Scott.
Congratulations on this new book, The Skin of Dreams. Tell me about how it came about.
Well, The Skin of Dreams is my first new and collected poems, and it spans, 20-some-odd years of struggling with this affliction called writing poetry.
Okay.
So it represents all 8 of my previously published books of poetry.
Right.
And then there's a section of newer poems, poems that had yet to be published in any of my single volumes of poetry.
And the new section, the first several poems, those have been written since the last book came out.
That's correct.
Okay.
And most of them have been, if not all of them, have been published in journals and or anthologies, but do not appear in one of my single volumes.
Okay. And finding a publisher for this, tell me about that.
Well, it's interesting. It's an interesting journey.
Yeah.
Working on a new and collected, because most new and collected books of poems by a poet are published by the publisher who was responsible for their previous collections,
right?
I have bounced around a bit in terms of my publishers by choice, really. And so this book is the first publication of a new publishing entity called the Calliope Group, LLC, which
okay.
is based here in Tulsa and also has offices in New York City. It is our goal, right, that this book will help launch the Calliope Group.
Yeah.
We have several other books in the pipeline.
Wonderful.
But this is the book to sort of help launch this publishing entity that we're very excited about. Publishing not only national authors, but many authors from Tulsa.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And from Oklahoma. Although, again, we do have an office in New York City where our fiction imprint primarily exists.
Okay, cool.
But very excited about providing an opportunity for local writers to see their work in print, you know, quality work representing the talented folks in Tulsa and in Oklahoma that don't often necessarily have access to other lines of getting their work out.
Right, right. And one other thing I should say about The Skin of Dreams, this new and collected book, is that it's not just new work plus your previous 8 books of poetry. It's like 23 or so years of writing. This is really like your journey as a poet.
Many of the poems, I should say, are autobiographical.
Right.
But certainly they—
But covering over 2 decades, really.
Two decades of my writing life, 2 decades of my life, period.
Exactly.
From the journey from Enid to Norman, to OU, where I met you.
Right.
to Chicago, New York, and back to Oklahoma. I mean, the poems span my life,
right.
Almost half my life.
Yeah, we should say just parenthetically that you're a friend and that I did meet you when I think you were an undergrad at OU, and I would go down there to hear like punk bands and new wave bands, and I'm sure I met you at some such slam dancing thing or other like
I'm sure of it.
Yeah, so, and I published your work in
Probably
this
the
slam.
Bowery.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah, or maybe it was Shadow Play Records in Norman.
Right?
Yeah. But anyway, I've published your work in This Land, a bygone literary journal here in Tulsa, and I'm a fan of your work. So
well,
I'm
thank
so
you.
Thrilled. Yeah, and I'm thrilled to have you on. You've been on Studio Tulsa before. I'm thrilled to have you back. You mentioned Chicago. You were there for 3 decades.
Right.
Now, that includes a couple of years in New York for grad school, but mainly Chicago for 30-odd years. And Gwendolyn Brooks was a mentor of yours. Tell me a little about, for those who don't know, Gwendolyn Brooks.
Well, Ms. Brooks is the first black person, black human, ever to receive the Pulitzer Prize, which she did in 1951 for her second book of poetry, Annie Allen. She was an amazing woman, a very exacting and precise poet, you know, was courageous.
Grew up in Chicago.
Right. She was born in Topeka, Kansas, and lived there for her first 3 months. And then and she always resented the fact that she could not call herself a native Chicagoan, although she was only gone for 3 months. Her mother took her to her grandmother's house to give birth in Topeka and then brought her back to Chicago. But Chicago consumed her work for the entirety of her life, particularly Black Chicago. And I believe, and some folks consider this a controversial thought, but I believe that she took one of her mentors, Langston Hughes, and another of her mentors, Richard Wright's, naturalism and detailing and minutia, the joys and the trials of living Black in urban America.
Right.
And Black in America, period, really.
But Harlem in particular.
Harlem in particular. And Ms. Brooks focused in her first book, A Street in Bronzeville, Bronzeville being a neighborhood on the south side of Chicago where I lived before I moved to Tulsa. She took the songs and the cries and the sounds and the activity of the young people and the old and explored those details, that minutia, in ways that further, I believe, what Langston Hughes did in his poems about Harlem. I believe that she was a more exacting poet in the simple ways of living and struggling to live and breathe as Black folks in Chicago. So I think she took what she learned from Richard Wright's naturalism, and advanced on both of those men's work in her own writing.
And they were Harlem Renaissance writers, of course. And is it therefore, in your view at least, safe to say that the Black arts movement sort of grew out of the Harlem Renaissance in that way? I mean, she was sort of a part of that movement, wasn't she?
Ms. Brooks and Robert Hayden were a part of what my friend Dr. Lawrence Jackson refers to as the indignant generation, which is the generation in between.
Transitional.
Right. In between the Harlem Renaissance or New Negro Movement and the Black Arts Movement. And Richard Wright had a great disdain for the writers of the Harlem Renaissance. He did not care for them because they weren't writing about the politics and the real struggles of what was happening in Harlem at that time. Hmm. Langston didn't go that deep.
Right.
And not until later in his life did his politics manifest in his writing. But there's a famous story that Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston, another great writer of that moment, were being celebrated and heralded at a party in a penthouse. Being celebrated by their white literary grandmothers and grandfathers and the white literary establishment in New York, who celebrated them and funded them, while on the street in front of that penthouse there was a race and labor war happening.
Wow.
Right?
Okay.
And Richard Wright was angry at those writers because they weren't writing about that race and labor struggle that was happening literally in front of that penthouse. Right? Mm-hmm. And so that is literally and figuratively how Wright is really the father of the Black arts movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could say that, I mean, it's certainly Amedee Baraka is the architect, right, is the leading, or certainly, and Askia Touré are the architects of the Black arts movement after Malcolm X was killed. But they gained their literary foundation really from Richard Wright, from his book of essays, where he's really condemning the lack of concern and attention paid to the struggles of Black folks in that moment.
Right.
Right? Because that's not what Zora was writing about. That's not what Langston was writing about till later in his life. And so that was Wright's gripe with the Harlem Renaissance writers. And the Black arts movement is born of Wright, from a literary standpoint, the poets, the writers, from Wright's foundation for talking about what is really happening and his certainly his socialism. Richard Wright's socialism,
right,
as a big factor in that, and then the teachings of El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, Malcolm X,
right,
also a very central foundation for the Black arts movement.
This is reminding me of a poem from the book, which is again sort of not just 23 years of poetry that you've created, but 23 years of your life. As you said, these are often very autobiographical poems. You have something about Gwendolyn Brooks called Elegy from page 28. Let's hear that if you don't mind.
Sure. And I should reference that I had the privilege of being mentored by Miss Brooks for the last 11 years that she was with us.
Right.
And I was one of 10 or 11 students in the last college level workshop she taught before she passed.
Wow.
And so,
then you were director of something called the Gwendolyn Brooks Center for Black Literature.
Right. At
Chicago State
University.
Right.
And so even before I met her, I was teaching her work. I was performing her work.
You had sort of, you were hip to her long before you met her.
Yeah, I was. And so like many of us, I was introduced to Miss Brooks via the poem We Real Cool. Right.
Widely anthologized poem.
Widely anthologized. So widely anthologized, she grew to loathe.
Oh, did she?
She often would say, I wrote other poems. Would you like anything
right.
else? Right.
Yeah.
So this elegy references We Real Cool.
Okay.
Elegy for Gwendolyn Brooks. 1. 12 years ago, met Chi-Town with $25, 2 suitcases, and a folder of poems in search of myself. You, Haki, and Malcolm had knocked enough red dirt from my eyes to see black. 2. I have seen your words change rural fourth graders into Southside pool toughs, hustling jazz in June. 3. In class, you ignited riots, watched us loot and ransack. 4. At dinner, your mortality stiffened me, forced to consider this in your absence, sobered by the bone of your words.
Wow, was this shortly after she died?
It would have been almost right after she passed.
Yeah.
I mean, when she passed, I was in grad school at NYU. And I knew she was not well. I was talking to Dr. Haki Madhubuti, founder of Third World Press, and her first cultural son.
Also a Black Arts Movement figure.
Right. And he would keep me abreast of her health. And so one night I called when he had called and said that she was not doing well. And so I called to see about her. And she did not know who I was.
Mm.
And the next day she was gone. And so I just remember to this day the pain in her voice. And the pain that I felt when she did not know after 11 years of very close mentorship and friendship. I saw her 3 months before she passed.
Yeah.
But that when she did not remember my name, she did not remember who I was. I knew that she was gone.
Yeah.
And that was a painful, sobering moment. And so I probably wrote this poem shortly after that. Yeah.
I'm wondering, before Chicago, before the trip to NYU for studies in poetry, how did you come to writing? You have this great line in that poem we just heard, Elegy, about a certain writer sort of knocking the red dirt out of your eyes.
Right.
Talk about first getting into writing, first thinking you might try writing a poem.
Well, I didn't write my first poem till I was a sophomore at OU.
Oh, really?
Interesting. At 19,
Wow.
Studying journalism, because I started to write poems because as a journalism student, we were supposed to be, right, unbiased, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote poems as a way to scream at people in the world because my studies would not allow me to scream at people in the world.
Okay.
So it was an outlet. It was cathartic.
Yeah.
But I fell in love with language growing up in Enid, being the youngest of 6 children. In a house full of the music of the Black Arts Movement from my older siblings. I still consider Stevie Wonder one of my greatest poetic influences.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. But even before that, when I was in third grade, I remember having conversations with one of my best friends at the time about why is this called sofa and why is this called a chair? Why is that called a car, right?
Yeah.
That what I didn't know was that I was fascinated not only with etymology,
right,
as we would define that now, but I was also fascinated with the idea that letters are symbols for sounds. You put the letters together in the right way, they'll make sound and they'll make meaning, right?
Mm.
If you put those letters that can become words, you put the words together in a syntactical manner, then you have sound, sense, and you have a kind of music.
Right.
Right. And so a part of that is growing up again in the church and performing in Christmas and Easter pageants or whatever with my cousins. But also this idea that I knew the words to say a Stevie Wonder song before I knew how to spell the words. And so this idea of the musicality of language was something that, I don't think I'm unique. I think that for many of us, the musicality of language is one of the ways in which we receive and learn vocabulary. I mean, the ABCs is a song.
It is, right?
So I think because of being the youngest of six, growing up in this house where, and actually my older siblings had Mama Nikki Giovanni and Baba Miri Baraka poems on the walls in their bedrooms.
Right.
And reading them and thinking, wow, well, that's interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Not fully understanding them, but, you know, this is a different way to play with language while I'm young and learning language.
Right.
And maybe wasn't even aware of the impact that the music and those poems on the walls and my sisters and my older brother's sort of cultural understanding informed my love for language.
Right.
I don't know that I fully understood that till well into my 30s.
Interesting. Probably. And you mentioned being an undergrad, studying journalism at OU, and having these various writing assignments you had to do where you had to be non-biased, just the facts and so forth, and that in poetry, at least at the outset, you were able to do a certain kind of complaining type of writing.
Screaming, shouting.
Now, that's obviously, you know, still a part of your project, still a part of what any poet is up to, but you're also very concerned with social justice in your work.
Right.
And that's, has that always been true?
That's always been true. I've always been a political writer.
Sure,
political
like overtly.
Poet, right. Overtly. I have attempted to certainly couch that politic in message and layer and meaning. You know, I believe, as Ms. Brooks taught me, that art should move us to think, not tell us what to think.
Hmm.
Although there are times when a poem or a song, that's what it needs to do. That's its function, like a rant. But most of the time, more times than not, I'm interested in moving a reader or a listener to think and not telling them what to think. And so my politics are layered in whatever the narrative of the poem may be or the lack of narrative. I've always been a socially engaged or politically or culturally engaged writer, and that has everything to do with being a black man.
Yes.
And I think a black man where I grew up, because I've always been engaged with history, and most of my work is some sort of a connection, a historical connection to how did we get to this moment now, what preceded it, and what may follow. Whether that moment is about my father, or whether it's about civil rights legislation from the 60s.
Right.
How did what preceded this moment that we're in? And then there's the personal politic of it, right? I'm interested in the moment, in the autobiographical poems, I'm referring to myself or family members or friends, but how does the external politics inform the internal politic,
right?
And vice versa.
Hearing you say the phrase just now, civil rights legislation from the 60s, reminds me of this poem you have in the book that I think grows out of, the poem's called All Talk, and it grows out of something from Chicago Public Radio called the Every Other Hour Project.
Right.
Talk about that project and the poem that you created for it, and then maybe we'll hear the poem.
Sure. Well, Every Other Hour is a series that WBEZ, Chicago Public Radio, created. And that phrase, every other hour, is because there's a shooting in Chicago. Not necessarily always a murder or a death, but there's a shooting. There's gun-related violence in Chicago every other hour.
Okay.
And so within that larger project, they have separate smaller projects. And so I was involved in a project called Inverse. And that is where a beat reporter from WBEZ, a poet, and a photographer were sent to the scene of a shooting. And so I coordinated, I was the producer for the poets and the editor for the poets. I selected the poets that were involved in the project, and then I engaged in it myself.
Okay.
And so one over a weekend, a Friday night, a Saturday night, I sat in their Southside satellite office with the photographer and the beat reporter, and we listened to police scanners, which was probably one of the more difficult aspects of the entire experience.
How so?
Because you're sitting listening to the police scanner, waiting to hear about the right kind of shooting to go and cover, right? Which seems very voyeuristic yes. and seems very twisted.
Right, right, right.
And so...
Because they're all, you know...
They all involve human life.
Indeed.
Right?
Right, so...
And in many instances, human death. And so that was painful. That was torturous. But we waited through a Friday night, gave up, went back on a Saturday night, and then went to cover a shooting on the west side of Chicago. And it was really something. I mean, again, I've studied journalism. I've worked professionally in journalism. And I've been on some scenes of some things.
Yeah.
But something like this was really, as a poet and as an older person, was very, very intense. Hmm. Very intense. So here's the poem.
All Talk.
For Chicago Public Radio's Every Other Hour series on gun violence. Victim, a male, black, 37, was involved in an argument on an endless sidewalk where a child's pink four-wheel brightened shadow of tumblers on canvas of west side sky. Biting air and unexpected August as helicopter hums its blinking eye on 71st place. This concrete outlines A-frames proud in their contrasting uniformity, quiet repose in the glare of a vigilant, almost open moon peeking between branches, both with secrets to share. Fragmented truths caged in police tape. Few others are talking, yet the street is loud and the front porch at this house pleads over the cacophony of Saturday night. A man, a son, a brother was shot on this stoop. MLK's determined face on the white front room wall questions the two distinct marks in the door and the spotty wood outside. Red and pink flowers puzzle the round table beneath him as he wonders if the 1966 march brought us the freedom to live where we choose and covers his ears to the immediate pain. Bigots in Virginia, cops talking Irish bars, and a black mama wailing like a siren. The victim's sister is an angry parade. Cops yell like she's a stranger on her own block. She curses them and worries the street about the whereabouts of her brother and the adolescent boy who sought refuge just after bullets spoke. This is an active crime scene, she is told, and denied entry to mama's house. Just an altercation, they say. Her tongue colors the neighbor's siding. Alley deep across the street, a crew of young men turn up their volumes with tales of shootings and defying death, in earshot of cops busy with routine distance.
Thank you. That is Horesh Ali Lanson, a reading from his latest book, The Skin of Dreams, New and Collected Poems, 1995 to 2018, and you're listening to Studio Tulsa. That's obviously a poem that's driven by what's going on in Chicago right now, what's going on in America right now.
Right.
This is a richly diverse collection that covers a lot of American ground as well as a lot of your own story.
Sure.
And I was thinking, we're running out of time, I'd love to get to the poems that deal with echolalia, which is a sort of vocal phenomenon.
Right.
That I was thinking of when you were talking about coming to poetry and getting interested in poetry for the musicality of language and mm-hmm. the repeating and the rhythms and the sounds. There's some fantastic persona poems from the perspective of Harriet Tubman and right. people in her world. But I want to close, if I could, with one last poem. And this is something that I think recently appeared in the Tulsa Voice. I take it it's one of your newer pieces.
Right.
It's called Tulsa Blur.
Right. The blur is a form that I created and looking forward to expanding on it. I actually just engaged in a workshop teaching with Tulsa Artist Fellows, my fellows,
right.
Introducing this form. And so part of the idea though of the form is to take something that has existed for longer than a decade and
As a literary construct or as a
And then identify its existence in both time frames. Say in this case 1921 and 2012 are the frame of the blur. And in 1921, of course, the Tulsa Race Massacre occurred.
Right.
In 2012, as you may recall, unfortunately, a very drunken, angry white man went on a shooting spree in North Tulsa.
Right.
Right. And randomly killed several black folks, which was his goal. And so I took 1921 and 2012. Those are the two frames. And then what's blurred here, the objects that I blur are bullet, language, and hate. Tulsa blur, 1921 to 2012. Red dust simmering below skin of earth is how bullet transcends muscle. History, a howling fire, gasoline to ravenous mouth, like language, like hate. Irritable June heat in March, a trigger, fuse drawn to surface, indecisive sky. Gunpowder ageless as blood, the north side of heaven ablaze. Africans tread Atlantic on familiar limbs. 91-year-old slug lurking in elevator shaft, bell curve, the front page of a newspaper, a senator's lips, the lynching bee, no, the cries, duped into minimum wage belief we are alive, buried in piles of our own toil, prosperity's rubble. Ancestors compelled to counsel, their pull stronger than our illusion, theirs the largest mob.
That penultimate line, ancestors compelled to counsel, their pull stronger, puts me in the mind of the sort of awakening mm-hmm. that's going on now. You grew up in Oklahoma. You grew up in Enid. I grew
right.
up in Tulsa. I didn't hear about the Tulsa Race Massacre until I was in college.
Right. That was by design in part, but
yeah. But I mean, was that your experience as well? That basically,
I didn't learn about the massacre until I moved to Chicago.
Okay,
and
wow.
I was 25.
Yeah.
And I was embarrassed and ashamed that I wasn't aware of it because it happened an hour and 40 minutes, you know, away.
Right, right, right.
But I was ashamed and embarrassed that I lacked that knowledge. But of course, as you know, part of that was by design. The state attempted to bury it and did successfully for almost a century. You know, and the fact that you and I were of an age where we grew up with Oklahoma history classes in middle school and it was never taught.
Right.
You know, so very much by design, you know, the fact that the front page of the Tulsa Tribune came up missing somehow, mm-hmm. you know, and that the state didn't acknowledge it until the 90s, until
yeah.
forced to acknowledge it.
And now, I might add, you're teaching at Holland Hall. And you're back in Oklahoma, and after all those years in Chicago, are you teaching the massacre to some degree? Are you?
Yes.
Are your students probably come to you already aware of it?
Some do, and some don't.
Uh huh.
I think that because we are nearing the centennial, there's been more information and programming that's in the works
for
the centennial, and so. It has been more in the news in the last several years here. Therefore, some young people who are paying attention to that news and that information have that knowledge, but still many people don't.
Yeah.
I talk about it. I do teach U.S. history, and I do teach English, so I do talk about it. So,
that's great.
Yeah.
Thank you for this fantastic book of poems and for your work and for teaching and for being back in Oklahoma and coming on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That is the poet and Tulsa artist fellow Koresh Ali Lansana. His new book is The Skin of Dreams, New and Collected Poems. There will be a free-to-the-public book launch and party for this volume tomorrow night, as in the 27th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Tulsa Artist Fellowship Archer Studios at 109 North MLK. In downtown Tulsa, I'm Scott Gregory. Sitting in today for Rich Fisher, thank you for listening.